Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. This is your host, Lance White. Tonight's guest is Dr. PMH Atwater. Dr. Atwater survived three death events that produced three different near-death experiences in 1977. She is one of the original researchers of the near-death phenomenon, having begun her work in 1978. Today, her contribution to the field of near-death studies is considered on par with those of Raymond Moody and Ken Ring. Her first two books, Coming Back to Life and Beyond the Light, are considered the Bibles of the near-death experience. With the publication of Future Memory, she has expanded her work into areas of brain development that call for a reconsideration of what is presently known about transformation consciousness. She has done extensive research into the after effects and the analysis of common elements of the NDE. Her research into children's near-death experiences led to her writing Children of the New Millennium. Her latest book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to NDEs, is the most comprehensive book on the subject to date. Tonight we'll be focusing on one of her other recent books, The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences. And so, before we announce any more books, let's get the real source out here on air so we can talk to her and find out what's going on. Welcome, PMH. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Lance. And by the way, the Idiot's book is out of print.
Uh-oh.
The most comprehensive book and the one that has the latest material in it, that's the Big Book of Near-Death Experiences, and that came out last October.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. And just to get a little mention in of the other book, you have one that is about the Indigo Children, which we probably won't get a chance to focus on too much tonight. What's the name of that one?
That's Beyond the Indigo Children.
Yes.
That's when we're getting beyond all these labels and taking a look at the kids themselves.
Yes. Well, we'll have to do another show on that.
Sure. We'll do that another time.
Yeah. You've had a fascinating life, and one would almost have to guess that you had planned it out this way before you incarnated, so that we all start at the same page. Maybe you could go back to your first experiences in 1977. What happened? What was the near-death experience like? I know you've talked about this a million times, but...
Well, you know. I usually try to avoid talking about my personal experiences, except to be very, very brief.
Okay.
Because we would be on the line for 2 hours.
Oh.
If you're just going to talk about my experiences.
Okay.
So let me just suffice it to say my first one occurred January the 2nd,
okay.
1977. I was living then in Boise, Idaho. I'm a good Idahoan.
Ah.
And the death was from a miscarriage and extreme hemorrhaging.
Huh.
The next one occurred 2 days later. That's January 4. That was because of a major thrombosis in the right thigh vein, which dislodged, followed by the worst case of phlebitis the specialist had ever heard of, let alone seen.
Mm.
And then 3 months later, March 29, we still don't know yet today for sure what killed me. They think it was a heart attack, but they haven't been able to really verify for certain. All they know is no vital signs.
Mm.
At all.
Mm.
And I did revive. So I did have 3 in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's January and March. And then later that fall, I had 3 major relapses, one of which was adrenal failure. So after this was all over, I got the privilege, if you will, of rebuilding an old body. That is to say, I had to relearn how to stand, how to walk, how to crawl, how to run, how to climb stairs, tell the difference between left and right, see properly, hear properly, and rebuild all my belief systems.
Uh-huh.
You know, when we're talking about the near-death experience, a lot of people kind of get into the stories, and they forget where those stories come from.
Uh-huh.
They usually come from violence, or they come from trauma. They come from people who are dealing with a lot more than just the near-death experience. They're dealing with a body that's non-functional.
Uh-huh.
Or there's, you know, various types of trauma that they have to deal with. So, you know, when we're talking about these experiences, we're really talking about a very large dynamic
mm-hmm.
that happens to people. And by the way, it happens to people of any age. That includes babes. That includes babies in the process of being born.
Mm-hmm.
It can. We have a lot of cases that come from birth trauma.
Mm-hmm. When did you begin researching these experiences? Then after you began recovering and
the year after.
And
uh-huh.
Then how did that come about?
Well,
is that another?
I'm gonna have to be real honest here.
Yeah.
And tell you that it was because of my third near-death experience.
Oh, okay.
I had reached that level that we in research call the realm of all-knowing.
Oh, wow.
That's that particular realm or space or area, I mean, you know, who knows what word to use, where all the puzzle pieces of your life come together and various revelations are made and, you know things or you're told things or whatever.
Yeah.
Most people, when they come back, they can only remember a little bit of it or sometimes they don't remember any of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was one of those that brought it back.
Wow.
And most of those revelations, well, most of what I witnessed is in my book, Future Memory.
Okay.
But after that occurred, and what I was able to witness was the inner workings of creation and consciousness, I honestly feel that I was at the center point of all creation and was able to see how that worked, how that functioned.
Okay.
And that's what I brought back.
Ah.
But when I was in that place, I heard a voice speak. And I don't, you know, how do you explain, you know, what words do you use? I call it the voice like none other.
Okay.
Because it seems inappropriate for me to call it anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
My sense was it was of God, but it seems arrogant to me to say, you know, God spoke to me. That just doesn't ring right to me.
Right, I like that, the voice like none other.
Yeah, so I call it the voice like none other, and the voice was very specific.
Uh-huh.
It said, and I quote, test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death.
Huh.
Book one was not named. Books two and three were named.
Huh.
I was shown what all that meant.
Huh.
I was shown what to be in each book, but I was not told how to do the work, how long it would take, none of that.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm literally alive today because of that voice and what I was told to do. I came back to do the work. And that's what I've been doing. My research base now is almost 4,000 adults and children. I've been keeping the kind of schedule. Well, for about the first 15 years, is about a 7-day-a-week job and maybe 12, 14 hours a day. Now it's down to maybe 5.5 days a week and maybe 8 hours a day.
You're getting
so it's a little normal now. But I'm getting close to the finish line, and that's when I complete my theoretical model. So the big book of near-death experiences is truly a one-of-a-kind, and I'm hopeful that it gets in all the hospitals, all the clinics, all the colleges, all the schools, in everybody's hands, pastors, ministers, imams. I hope it gets in as many hands as possible, because that book gives us 360-degree look at the experience, the after effects, and the implications.
Wow.
Plus it also examines transformations of consciousness and the near-death-like experience as well. You know, one of the things I want to say for your audience, Lance, that is so important, and I want to say that I want to say this right off the bat. It's literally an announcement. And that is because of four clinical prospective studies, major ones, done in three countries, and a plethora of papers now published in peer-reviewed journals. Because of that, within the last 2 years, the near-death experience is now the number one choice of scientists worldwide to study consciousness itself.
Mm.
Things like out-of-body experiences,
mm-hmm.
the dead come back,
mm-hmm.
visitors from the other side, otherworldly
mm-hmm.
journeys are no longer relegated to things like oxygen deprivation, anoxia, the dying brain,
right.
hallucinations.
Right.
They're now today considered normal and typical of the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, Lance, that the conversation changes.
Yeah.
The entire conversation changes. And if you just kind of hang with that,
mm-hmm.
then you begin to realize the entire conversation changes.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about spirit beings, when we're talking about the other levels and realms,
mm-hmm.
when we're talking about life after death and being able to converse concurrently with beings on various levels, and we still on our level, it's no longer the mystical conversation that it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the whole conversation now has turned, and it's done it in just the last 2 years.
Wow.
The major shift.
Wow. Would you attribute some of that shift in regards to the energies that are occurring on the planet at this time?
Well, you could kind of say that, because that certainly would have motivated science to the degree that it has been motivated. But I would rather say that it's because of a lot of dedicated people like myself
mm-hmm.
who have been working very hard for a lot of years and have consistently and continuously done the work, written the papers, got them through the peer-reviewed process, and so that we now have a body of material that stands up to scientific protocols
mm-hmm.
and enables doctors now to open up.
Well, yes, and I was just reading one doctor's regression therapies where he takes people into the in-between life, between the incarnated.
There's a number of doctors doing that now. That is true.
And I think that they're also, you would know better than I about there being so many near-death experience groups popping up everywhere where people are beginning to acknowledge their experiences and remember them without shame or guilt.
Well, this is the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and we lovingly call it IANS, you know, just
mm-hmm.
take their initials.
Mm-hmm.
And they are international.
Mm-hmm.
They do have groups all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so all anyone has to do is get on their website, which is www.iands.org, and inquire about groups in your area or how to start a group yourself.
Yes. And to read the stories and questions.
Yeah, and be
answers.
A member. And you know, just now, you're just finding out about this. I mean, it's just now happening.
Yeah.
IANS is moving from Connecticut to Durham, North Carolina.
Huh.
They're moving in with the Rhine Institute.
Huh.
Isn't that something? They're doing it right now.
Oh, how wonderful.
So people can find out about the new changes just this week. And
wow.
I think up until the 5th of next week, people can buy the journals for 75% off.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, yeah, people need to get on that website right away. And my own website as well. It's just myname.com, so it's www.pmhatwater.com.
When you began researching these experiences, what were some of the common denominators that you found?
Well, what I found was that the pattern, I didn't find the pattern that everybody else was talking about that I found out years and years later.
Hmm.
And I began to wonder about this, and we now know today that I was on the right track.
Hmm.
Because we know that the classical model is really not that classical. Excuse me.
Okay.
In other words, you don't have to have all of these elements, like 5, 6, 8 of them, to have a near-death experience. You can just have one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a couple of them. That's what kids do. Kids usually have about 1 or 2 or 3 elements. That's it. And they'll still get the full pattern of physiological and psychological after effects, just like adults do. So if we're going to look at the major elements that occur, number one is the out-of-body experience.
Right.
Most people have that.
Right.
And invariably, we can get third-party verification on what they see, what they witness, where they go, what they learned when they were there. These out-of-body experiences can be very intense. They can be very complicated. They can be very long. Just to give you a quick example, it's not that unusual for the person, once they're pronounced dead in the hospital and the sheet is, you know, pulled over the person's face, and they're being prepared, being taken to the morgue, then the people at the hospital call the person's home to tell the people at home that their loved one has died. It's not that uncommon for the person to go home. So they're there, and they see who answers the phone.
Oh, my goodness.
They can describe what they're wearing.
Wow.
And here's the whoops factor. They can tell you everything they said.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, and
you
that
know,
kind of,
that's a little what, that can be embarrassing.
And
of course, the light. That's another big one that that most of the people see. Not everyone, but most people. And that light, adults describe it as brighter than a million suns, that it's alive, it knows their name, it knows all about them, and it's all intelligence.
Yes.
So we've got those two, the out-of-body experience and the light.
Okay.
The other thing that's very, very common is to be met by loved ones who had died and gone on before. In other words, there's a greeter of some kind.
Right.
There's not always a greeter, but in most cases there's a greeter. And very often that greeter is an animal.
Well,
you know, most people think, well, it's just, you know, a person.
Huh.
No, it's not. Many times it's an animal.
I hadn't heard that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Especially a pets that have died and gone on.
Oh, I'd love to have my pet.
Many times will come back. Sometimes it's an animal that was not a pet.
Huh.
What I've found, especially with children, children get a lot of birds and bunnies and little turtles. They get the little creatures. And adults will usually get the larger ones.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting that it, you know, comes out that way. It's not always that way, but, in most cases it does.
No one's seen an elephant yet, have they?
No, I haven't heard that one yet. I have heard horses and lions. But I haven't heard the elephant yet.
Oh, good.
And then, maybe about a third of them will have a life review.
Yes. Tell us, can you delve into that a little bit more?
Well, the life review, different people talk about it different ways. Like this one woman, she was led into this large room, very, very large room, high ceilings. And the walls all the way around were layers upon layers upon layers, ceiling to floor, of television sets. They were all on. And in each screen was a different segment of her life. And so she was literally viewing all these TV sets, but she said it wasn't just a viewing. She could feel what was going on in each one that she looked at. Some people say, well, it's like going into a theater and you're watching a movie of your life. But most people say that you relive it all. That you're not watching it, you're reliving it. And a lot of people in this reliving process talk about reliving the pain or the difficulty they caused to someone else. They relived that in that person's body, in that person's life, and what happened to that person.
And all those three people who were affected by that person.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
That's
so you don't just get your life review. You can very often get the consequences of your actions on others and their review.
Yeah, yeah.
So it can be very, very traumatic and very complicated and, you know, very shocking to realize, oh, my gosh, did have that effect.
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. You know, it's like, whoa.
You would think that if that occurred for each lifetime, that errant souls would somehow alter their destructive paths of genocide or greed or corruption, and yet we seem to see people get more crystallized in that path. Is there a reason for that that you're aware of?
I can't speak to that as a researcher.
Okay.
On the near-death experience. I have to stay with my research. If you're going to talk to me as a visionary counselor, then I would be talking a little bit differently.
Okay.
But if I'm talking about research, then I sort of need to stick with that.
Right, okay.
Because we can't verify anything like that through research.
Okay. Well, that'll be an open question.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we can sort of flow out into the esoterics and the mysticism, but that's, you know, kind of a different hat.
Okay.
And it is another hat I wear, but that's certainly not in my books.
So then you want to continue a little bit about what we were just speaking about? So they go.
Well, you know, if you're talking about the various characteristics, those are the main ones.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Now, certainly you can have people that go on and on and on and have others.
Right.
You know, some people hop a light ray and tour the universe. Some people see all of history from beginning to end.
Right, right.
Some people wind up in some kind of heavenly college or school.
Right.
Some people wind up in a meadow and start dancing. And other people, you know, they're walking along a road. And invariably there's something like a line of demarcation, a particular line they can't cross. And invariably that line is a river. It's not always a river, but usually it's a river.
Huh.
And they know if they cross that, they can't come back. So the old stories from, you know, ancient Greece that they talk about these rivers, that's upheld in near-death counts. There's a lot of those.
So those are actually almost like membranes or barriers, so to speak.
It's a barrier of some kind.
That we,
yes.
And then we see it as a metaphor, as a river. Or
well, people talk about the actual river, that they really see it, and the water is not like water we have here. It's translucent, it's golden, it's clear, it's very beautiful water.
Also, some talk about taking a drink from the river of forgetfulness before they return.
Well, now we're getting into the esoterics.
Okay, all right.
And we're getting into that mystical idea of how this all comes about.
Okay.
And, you know, like Edgar Cayce, the sleeping prophet,
right,
and other really great prophets and mystics of old, even our newer ones, perhaps even yourself, who talk about this kind of thing. Some people come into this life with that memory. Some people gain that memory later on when you are awakened. Some people talk about certainly drinking from a certain water or being touched by an angel on the middle of the forehead so that however it happens, so that you don't remember the other side or the other realms or different lives or past lives or parallel lives or, you know, we could, you know.
Because it would be confusing for us.
Well, it messes things up. You know, it's enough to get your job accomplished with just this particular focus.
Yeah, tell me about it.
You know, yeah. if you if you can remember the other stuff, then it gets a little messy.
Yes, it could. It could. It definitely
I know
could.
It did for me as a child. If we want to get a little personal here, I can say that as a child, I could remember, and clearly so, where I had been a prostitute in France in a previous life, and I had given birth to a daughter.
Oh, my goodness.
And could not, or, you know, just couldn't really love her. The guy that I was the mistress for gave me enough money, you know, to take care of her, but she finally hated me and ran away. And well, in this lifetime, she was my mother.
Oh, of course.
She was my, and as a child, I refused to accept anything she told me to do because I knew that she was my mother. And I would not obey her. And in those days in ancient France, you know, or older France, the prostitutes wore green sleeves. You know that song, Green Sleeves?
Yeah.
It's about a French prostitute.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh.
And my mother was always forcing me to wear green or green sleeves, and I hated green. You know, we had a lot of these correspondences. So, you know, again, if we're going to get esoteric, we can talk about these particular traits that follow through and the patterns that continue. And, of course, that's very fascinating to do that kind of thing.
Oh, sure.
But if you just look at good old-fashioned science and hardcore research, you begin to come up with a lot of this same or similar material coming in very non-esoteric ways, and that's why I'm saying the conversation is changing.
Okay.
Because we can now look at the esoterics and the mysticism fresh and new and differently.
Right.
And we can look at it with different eyes and saying, oh, this is not just psychic stuff.
Right.
This
right.
is not just, you know, you're going to some kind of medium or channeler. This has more of an element of reality now. And people are beginning to remember this or bring it back or re-experience it. We had one child experiencer. It's in my book, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. His name was Rand, I think it was Jamison Shields. Right after his experience, he began to re-experience past lives. When I say right after his experience, I meant his near-death experience. And then he began to re-experienced past lives, and he re-experienced 80 of them.
Good night.
80.
Wow.
80 of them.
Wow.
And I talk about it in the book.
Wow.
And he was able to come up with specific details in, what was it, 30-some of them or something like that?
My goodness.
Where he was able to draw pictures of the places, the people, remember facts like people's names, street names, absolutely specific, stunningly specific.
Wow. Well, now it seems like if we, if people can go back into past lives, why can't we go into future lives as well?
Well, interestingly enough, in near-death experiences, we do get some that are futuristic in the sense that they will come back talking about the future. Well, you know, I kind of hesitate to use the word predictions, but seeing future events, that does happen.
Okay.
In other words, instead of having a past life review, they will have a pre-life review or how do you term it for future? Anyway, they'll come back with some of that future knowledge. Although not that many do. Not that many do.
Interesting.
Not that many do. And I kind of wonder if it's because of the variables. Because it really depends on what you're doing now that will change the future energetics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you're going to talk about the future being one way or another, or who you're going to be in a future life, well, maybe that's true and maybe that's not.
Maybe not, yes.
Because of the energetics of free will and how things occur.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's always going to be changing things.
Well, now, in your own work with people and your own experiences, there was no sense of judgment or blame or... there was no sense that of negativity surrounding our actions, was there, in terms of this life review?
Well, you know, you hear a lot of experiencers say this. A lot of them claim this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really not true.
Okay.
In some of the experiences, you do get the judgment factor. You do get lecture experiences. The scenario will be a lecture.
Okay.
Especially with children. With children more than adults. And I find this fascinating. The children are often met by what I call a caring or critical parent type greeter.
Okay.
And it seems to be that greeter's job to instruct the child as to how their behavior as they grow up and, you know, what they're to do and their job and their task and how they're to perform it. And sometimes they can be very strict. And sometimes they can be very extremely strict. I was
really?
Going to say nasty, but, you know, how do you term that? But they can be extremely strict.
Well, could that also have to do with the soul's age? That is, if it was a relatively young soul.
Well, that's conjecture, and that would be very difficult for me to say.
Mm.
All I can say is it does happen.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
It doesn't seem to be always a free lunch. You know, it's like sometimes you're really held to the mark, and sometimes you do that for yourself.
Right.
Because you're so traumatized or shocked by the life review,
mm-hmm.
and your behavior and the consequences of that behavior, that you can be very judgmental of yourself. It's not God that's judging
right.
you, it's
right.
you that's judging you.
Right, right.
But with children, very often it's the greeter
okay.
that will be rather strict or critical.
From all of these experiences that you can draw upon, what would you say some of the reasons are that we do incarnate and that we do enter into this third-dimensional reality?
Well, I can't draw that from research.
Again.
Because it just doesn't show. There's no way that I can pull that out or it comes out. Or it surfaces, it might surface for the individual years later, and especially if they go back and interpret their experience,
right.
or change their interpretation in any way, or expand on their interpretation in any way.
Uh-huh.
And so if you look at it from that end, or with that kind of view, then you get a broad span. Some children are very specific, and again, I talk about this in the new children and near-death experiences. Some are very specific about why they're on this planet.
Uh-huh.
And they have this very clear memory of having come here from another planet.
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, this one boy in Argentina, Flavio, was very, very clear that he came from the sun. And that he didn't come from the sun in the sense of being a dweller upon the sun, but he came from the sun in the sense of that was one of the planets and stars he had to go to and be instructed so that he could come here to Earth and do what he had to do here.
Huh.
there's about not quite a third of the kids that I worked with that kept saying to me, we're here for the changes. We're here for the changes.
Mm.
And they had memories of being bits and pieces of the universe. In other words, they weren't souls as we think of souls.
They might be cosmic matter or planets.
They were matter.
Oh,
they were asteroids or bits and pieces of this, or they were a scalar wave or whatever.
Wow.
And they were answering an SOS from planet Earth.
Wow.
Planet Earth needed help. And it's like planet Earth sent out this little SOS call, and whoever and whatever answered that call to come to Earth and be here for the changes.
Wow.
But they had to go through various steps to be able to do that.
Uh-huh.
And Miriam talked about they had to go from planet to planet, and each one, they would learn certain things, or they would become more dense, or they would become better able than to inhabit a human body and to live as an embodied being on the Earth plane.
Wow.
So I, you know, not quite a third of my kids talked about this. And when I was very intrigued with the idea that, well, you know, hey, these little children are saying, I'm here for the changes. Well, what do you mean changes?
Yeah.
Well, they're talking about the Earth and not necessarily helping the people, although they could,
right.
But they're here to help the Earth. I mean, these are the kids that are so into green, so into helping the Earth, so into, you know, the ecology.
Uh-huh.
So and so into becoming like things like bioengineers. I mean, these are the ones that are here to help the Earth. So you can't ask for years because, you know, that's a waste of time. So what I said was, what will you look like when the changes occur? In general, at least. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself when the changes occur? Well, invariably, the children would say something like, well, I'm a grandmother with grandkids, or I'm a grandparent, or I'm an older adult, and I have young children, or I have middle-aged children. So I pulled out my little calculator, you know, and the age of the child and, you know, how old they might be when they have kids or they have grandkids. And it all came out the same period of time, same clunk of time.
Huh, what was
same
that?
Same years.
How many?
And that's the years 2013 to 2020.
Wow.
That's after the Mayan calendar.
After
not before.
Them. Okay.
But you know, the real biggie is, if you get that book, Generations, which was written by William Strauss and Neil Howe, I'm also a generational researcher.
Okay.
And these are two of my heroes. They're really, really good in researching generations. You know, these are statistical researchers.
Okay.
You know, hardcore researchers.
Okay.
And in the back of the book, Generations by William Strauss and Neil Howe, H-O-W-E, Howe.
Okay.
They do some projections ahead as to when our country, our society, our culture would, what it would be like in the years ahead and the people in the new generations coming in, and what they would be facing.
Uh-huh.
And they found a particular period of time where they said the energy, the things going on during this period of time would be equal to all the major wars that the United States has had ever fought, but one of them. I forget which one it was. It might have been World War One, but I'm not sure. But all the other wars, put them all together.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Civil War, World War II, Spanish-American War, all these different wars, put them all together.
Uh-huh.
And it would be comparable to that. They called it apocalyptic.
Huh.
For both good and ill. So it would be a very energetic time, a very powerful time, and it could be a time when we might not survive as a country. They
huh.
were not sure. And it's the same time frame, Lance,
oh,
2013 to 2020.
Well, that makes a lot of sense if you look at where we're, you know, coming from.
So, you know, there'd certainly be a lot of energy then and a lot of crisis then.
Mm.
But, you know, we always have free will. You know, what are we going to do about it?
Well, that's true.
You know, if we get involved, if we do our part, then maybe it's not going to be that bad. I don't know.
And
but,
also, this is totally hypothetical and definitely maybe a little bit out of the box. But
sure.
There are quite a few people who believe that we have help from beings that are not particularly of this planet, and that, you know, they've been watching us for a long, long time, in fact, you know, guiding things from the beginning of time.
Right.
So, you know, it wouldn't be surprising, but...
Well, remember, the kids said, William Strauss and Neil Howe said there would be brilliant, absolutely brilliant things that happen, and inventions progress in society also. So they didn't say it would be all bad by any means. But
well,
whatever happened, it would be a lot of power, a lot of energy. It would not be a simple time.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically is what the kids are saying. They're here for the changes.
Well, now, some people also claim that psychics can't see, there's some kind of veil beyond 2012, 2013, 2011. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
I
would question that.
Okay.
I know a lot of this stuff out now is a lot of it's alarmist, a lot of it's misleading, a
right.
lot of it's exaggerated. I think we need to be a little bit careful.
How do you feel about the Mayan prophecies? In terms of their dates and what that might signify for us?
Well, personally, I respect it.
Okay.
Because when you look back, they've been pretty accurate.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you look at what's going on now, they are still accurate.
Yes, that's true. Very good point.
So I listen, you
yeah,
know?
Least,
I mean, I
yeah.
think this is... I'm very respectful of this,
yes.
but I also realize and note that even though the calendar ends in either 2011 or 2012, depending on what interpretation you go by,
mm-hmm.
because there's those two, you know,
right, right.
Depending on which one, we're still getting up the next morning.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's still, you know, life goes on. All that ends is that particular way of living on planet Earth and that particular way of thinking. So we're shifting.
Yes.
And it's up to all of us how we shift. You know, one of the things that excites me so much right now, Lance, is so many of the new children that are a little bit older now.
Uh-huh.
Are getting involved in politics.
Are you saying they're in their teens, 20s, maybe?
Oh, yeah. 30s? Some of them are in their.
Well, the Indigos have been around for quite a long time now.
Well,
I mean,
you know, if we take these labels, Indigo, Crystal, Starseed, Cosmic, all these labels,
right.
and just throw them out the door.
Okay.
And look just at the qualities,
right.
the patterning of the... You can literally take the characteristics of all these labels, bunch them all together,
uh-huh.
and you've got the profile of the new kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you can take that patterning of human being, and you can trace that You can recognize people like that at the time of Jesus, when Jesus walked the earth.
Oh, there weren't
that many, but there were a few.
Oh, absolutely.
We've had large amounts of them come in during any time that the earth had a renaissance. Not just the, you know, the European Renaissance, but there's been a number of different renaissances on our planet. We had another large group come in about the mid-1800s.
Mm-hmm.
From the mid-1800s till about 1920, we had just a large, huge group of these people come in. Then we started seeing them again in the 60s
mm-hmm.
and in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But the floodgates really opened wide in 1982. And from now on, that's all we're getting is these new kids.
Mm-hmm.
Do they all have indigo auras? No, they do not.
Okay.
Not at all. That's why we need to toss these labels. The labels are doing more harm than good.
Right, right.
And I'm saying to people, please read Beyond the Indigo Children and get on my website and read the addendum to the book that keeps it updated. It's called Beyond the Indigo Children Extras. And that will help you to put things in perspective.
Also, one thing that I just wanted to mention briefly is that many parents are led by their doctors to sedate or medicate their children. How do you feel about this?
No. In some cases, I think that's justified, but very few.
Hmm.
What we now know, for instance, on ADD, the average child that has that, most of the children that have that, will outgrow it in 3 to 4 years.
Right. And don't the drugs mask all of your abilities, you know, your ability to think and feel? And
most of the new kids have those kinds of qualities.
Yeah, yeah.
They come in with it. They're born with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like that as a child myself.
I've heard of people who, as being in the womb, communicated with their parents psychically.
Well, yes. Yeah,
so,
and of course, you know, we're deviating now from the near-death experience.
Well, all right, let's...
We're getting into esoterics here, Lance.
All right, well, let's sit back again.
Well, you're just going to have to get me on your show again, and we'll discuss the
will.
New children. No, I really, 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 really am so passionate, really, about people getting a hold of the Big Book of Near-Death Experiences, by people realizing that the conversation has changed, the entire field has changed, and because of that, how we feel about ourselves, our own memories, our own feelings, we can respect that now and not feel that we're weird or... We can even take terms like psychic and sort of toss that and say, hey, folks, this is normal.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing extra about it.
Yeah, right, it's normal. Well, and the another thing is it reduces judgment, because if you've incarnated as a, you know, as a prostitute in one life and a, you know, maybe a homosexual in another and a rapist in another, then we've gone through all of these gamuts.
I think just about everybody has.
Yeah, and so we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg when we look at each other. We're not seeing the truth. And
well, what we're seeing is what we're doing now with who and what we have builded ourselves to be.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing the current focus.
Right.
And that's important, to see that current focus, to be aware of the patterns of our own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter where you turn, whether it's religion or mysticism, the injunction is always to know thyself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's the injunction.
Absolutely.
Know thyself. And the more you get to knowing about yourself, the more you study or work on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The more you begin to recognize these patterns in your own life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And don't you find, too, that often souls will incarnate with a certain soul grouping, for instance.
Oh, absolutely. I talk about that at length in my book, We Live Forever.
Mm-hmm.
That does come from near-death research.
Mm-hmm.
We get into the soul. When we do that, it changes our conversation about heaven and hell. It changes our conversation about souls. And we begin to realize that the souls can come in waves or groups,
mm-hmm.
and affect historical times and
mm-hmm.
eras. They can come in pairs, or they can come in clusters.
Mm-hmm.
It just changes the way you look at a lot of that.
Mm.
But I truly feel that, excuse me, I'm sorry, I truly feel that the near-death experience really shows that the soul exists.
Yes, that's the number one important, I think that's probably the most
important. Well, that's a big thing
it is.
For our society, Lance, to just say that.
It is, because
that the soul exists.
Yeah, and most people walk around like they're just a lump of dead flesh that's going to die, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, well,
you
it's
know,
not.
And then that includes not being responsible for your actions, because there isn't anything that happens afterwards. So to me, one of the most important ideas out of all of this research is also that everything is recorded, and we'll be able to view, you know, our own soul's journey and its positive benefits and its negative ones, and we'll have to, at some point, look at that in an objective way. That it doesn't just disappear, that there are Akashic records or, you know, records from which we view, whether it's a television screen or a high-definition television.
Right, or reliving it.
Maybe it's Blu-ray over there now. In fact,
I think we need to take that step beyond just talking about what we learn from the scenarios,
mm-hmm.
and realize that these people, when it's over, most of them will begin to exhibit the pattern of after effects. And again, when we're talking about the pattern of after effects, they are physical as well as psychological. So we're not just talking about people who become more generous and kind afterward,
uh-huh.
and become more loving afterward. We're talking about people who go through long spans of depression.
Okay.
They get very confused. They have to deal with a whole span of after effects. Most of them become more sensitive to light and sound.
Mm-hmm.
They begin to think differently, talk differently. The body begins to behave differently.
Mm-hmm.
With most of them, for instance, much, much lower blood pressure.
Mm.
The blood pressure lowers. Stenesthesia, they begin exhibiting stenesthesia. Stenesthesia is multiple sensing.
Oh, okay.
Where it's like, for instance, the average near-death experiencer, when, let's say they're going to decorate their house or going to decorate their bedroom, they're going to buy a painting. They're not going to buy it just for the colors and how it looks. They're also going to buy it for how it sounds.
Really?
So that's your multiple sensing. Sensing comes in multiples.
Fascinating.
Many of them, 75% in my research base, I think it's 75, exhibited electrical sensitivity afterward. That's where you're popping light bulbs, or you can't wear watches, you know, you screw up the tape recorder or the microphone. That can be very expensive also, by the way.
You better buy a Timex watch. It's a bank.
Well, I can't wear watches at all anymore.
Really?
Oh, I just gave up with that.
Well, plus you had the additional benefit of knowing your soul's purpose, that you had a goal of...
No, I didn't know my soul's purpose. Let's be very clear here, Lance.
All right.
I was told to do what
I'm
doing.
Oh, you were told to do it. Okay.
I was told to do it.
All right. In no uncertain terms.
Yes, in no uncertain terms.
And that was the strict taskmaster.
Yes.
With the you know, with the ruler.
Yeah, well, yeah, just about like that.
But did you feel that there was a sense of love behind that? Or not?
Well, you know, I don't know how to describe that love. Because it was love, but it was the kind of love that was so all-encompassing and so overwhelming and so everything that it's hard for me to call it love. It was everything.
Wow.
So, you know, it's like love is the glue that holds the universe together. But when we're talking about that kind of love, the love gets so big that to use the word L-O-V-E just doesn't cut
it.
It's like it doesn't describe it enough.
Yeah.
It's more than that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just, you know, my sense was God. It's like the whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
And again, you just get lost with words. You know, what kind of words are you going to use?
Well, yeah, that's understood. Before we reach the end of the hour, I'm going to let you kind of loose here to share whatever you'd like to share with the listeners about, you know, anything that you'd like to share about before we, you know, actually have to sign off.
Well, one of the things I'd like to share is the most oft-repeated phrase, most near-death experiences, the vast majority of near-death experiences say after their experience, and it's just four words. And those four words are, always there is life. Always there is life. Now, if you really look at that, Lance, and sort of hang on those four words.
Okay.
If that's true, and I believe it is, then how can there be an afterlife? How can there be a before life? How can there be anything but life and life ongoing that forever can be counted on, because that's all there is?
Wow. And speaking of all there is, we just got the sign to sign off.
Well, that was good timing.
Well, thank you, PMH, so much for being on tonight. And just mention your website one more time before we go.
www.pmhatwater.com. And the big book of near-death experiences.
And we will have you back for sure, because we've got so much more to talk about.
You take good care of yourself, Lance.
All right, you too. Thanks a million.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.